This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Without putting too fine a point on it, what if Jay Powell and Janet Yellen are just wrong? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 25th day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A couple of facts as we get going, and then some analysis of the stakes of the great is inflation transitory or not debate of 2021. As of the most recent reading, headline inflation at the consumer level in this economy is running at 5.4%. That is fact number one. Fact number two is that both Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell and his predecessor and current Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen have been A, firm, and B, vocal in insisting that while, yes, inflation is real and might last another year or so, it will eventually reveal itself to be, say it with me now, I know you can, come on, transitory. But again, what if they're wrong?
If the Fed is wrong, it will be late. And if it is late, it's going to have to slam on the brakes. And if it has to slam on the brakes, history suggests we end up in a recession and we may end up with financial instability.
That was Mohamed El-Erian. He's the chief economic advisor at Allianz. He was on this program about 4 or so months ago, which is where that tape is from. And look, this is a real debate with real consequences. So we asked Marketplace's Sabri Benishour to explain what is at stake.
Yep, we are still talking about inflation, and that is because there is still a lot of anxiety out there over whether it is temporary or not. Alan Detmeister is an economist with UBS. He, like the Fed, is very much team temporary, but, you know, what if they're wrong?
If the monthly numbers are still coming in very strong, say, through the middle of next year and into the fall, what then you start to look at is, okay, is it time to start raising rates at that point?
Raising interest rates to intentionally slow the economy down. The Fed would do that because that is how, historically, you fight inflation. And historically, it has not been pretty.
In an extreme case, it could be a repeat of what we saw in the early 80s, where it throws the economy into a recession.
But it probably won't come to that, says Marvin Lowe, a senior strategist with State Street Global Markets. There are still a lot of reasons to think inflation will come back down next year.
What we're dealing with now is higher prices, no doubt, but they're coming from things that are not necessarily structural in nature.
Not structural as in not permanent. Supply chain problems, energy spikes, these are things that should get worked out. One thing some people worry about is whether inflation is getting baked in to wage growth and expectations, but so far it's not, says Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics.
Wage growth has improved, particularly among low-wage workers, but productivity growth has also picked up, you know, lockstep. So the actual cost to businesses, it really hasn't changed. So they're not under pressure to raise prices more aggressively.
At least for now. We won't know the answer to this inflation problem till 2022, so I guess we're going to keep talking about it till then. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
We are indeed going to keep talking about it until then. All right, moving on. President Biden was in New Jersey this afternoon drumming up support for his economic agenda, the granular details of which we will stay away from because, honestly, who can keep track? About all we know is that it's not going to be the $3.5 trillion over 10 years that was the plan originally. And that is going to mean the investment in some key programs is going to have to be smaller. Marketplace's Amy Scott takes up affordable housing.
Affordable housing advocates had high hopes for this bill and the more than $320 billion initially included for housing. It would have funded up to 750,000 new housing choice vouchers, which help low-income people afford private rentals. Carol Galante is founder of the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley.
It would put us a huge step forward from where we are today, where only one in four people who would qualify for a voucher are able to obtain one.
And even then, the average wait time is more than 2 years, says Will Fisher at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
We know vouchers are highly effective at reducing homelessness and housing instability and overcrowding, but the program's never been funded at anywhere near the level that's needed to meet the need.
It's not clear what the final legislation will include. Diane Yentel is CEO of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. She's pushing negotiators to keep programs that would repair and preserve aging public housing and build more affordable apartments.
These investments could literally end homelessness in our country, which has tremendous benefits to children, to families, to communities, and to the country.
But that's an argument advocates are likely making for childcare, paid leave, Medicaid expansion, as everyone fights for their piece of a much smaller pie. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, record highs, because, of course, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've still got 8 weeks, give or take, until winter is officially here, but this much we already know. Staying warm this year is going to be expensive. Natural gas was up 12% today. 12% just today. Propane's up, heating oil is up, multi-year highs, and expected to stay there. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on energy for us today.
That combination of colder temperatures and higher energy prices means a lot more people may be facing some difficult choices soon.
They call it the heat or eat dilemma.
Diana Hernandez is at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health.
When winter heating costs are high, it's also very commonplace for people to start to pull back on other consumables.
Like food. This is known as energy insecurity, and Hernandez says it affects 1 in 3 U.S. households. When energy prices are high, heating bills tend to go up the most for people who live in poorly insulated, inefficient homes, says Ariel Drehobel at the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy.
Low-income households and communities of color, especially Black and brown households, are much more likely to live in older buildings that are less efficient, that require more energy to keep them safely heated and cooled.
There's a federal program called LIHEAP to help people who are struggling to afford their energy bills. But Michelle Graff at Cleveland State University says it's historically underfunded.
And typically they're only able to help between 20 and 25% of the income eligible population.
She'd like to see more funding for LIHEAP, but there's also a lot more to be done, says Ariel Drehobel at the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy.
We really need to look to solutions such as energy efficiency and weatherization to help folks who, you know, already have high bills.
And lower those bills in the long term. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
We take you now to the town of Hatch in southern New Mexico, which calls itself the chili capital of the world. At least it was. Because these days, Hatch Valley farmers are just as likely to grow onions or alfalfa as they are to grow some of the chili varieties that made that area famous. The New Mexico Chili Association says production statewide is down 75% from its peak in the early 1990s, 34,000 acres down to 8,000 or so planted in chilies lately. Marketplace's Savannah Marr hit the road to Hatch to find out why.
Even in October, with the harvest season winding down, Hatch's chili offerings are expansive. You can buy them fresh at the farm stand, flame-roasted from half a dozen street vendors along the town's main drag, even in your milkshake at one local diner. At another restaurant, the Pepper Pot, chili is all over the menu. Between the breakfast and the lunch rush, owner Melva Aguirre is sorting through 40 pounds of roasted green chilies from a local grower.
I'm going to separate the big chili from the little bitty one. The big chili, I'm going to use it to make rellenos.
For the uninitiated, that's a chili that gets stuffed with cheese, battered, and fried.
And the little ones, what I do with them, I chop it.
To make green chili sauce.
This is the one we use for the enchiladas and to smother the burritos.
Aguirre opened the Pepper Pot 26 years ago. Before that, she worked as a cook in other chili restaurants around town. And before that, she and her family worked as harvesters in the chili fields. Now, outside of the late summer tourism season, chili growers are her main clientele.
I'm not even can see myself doing anything else. It's just a way of life.
But that way of life is getting less dependable. 20 years ago, Aguirre says the farmers who eat at her restaurant were growing nothing but chilies.
But now the farmers are growing different crops now. They're growing a lot of pecans. They're growing now watermelons, Halloween pumpkins, and hay. So if it doesn't go good with the chili, they still got the other crops to survive on.
One of those farmers is Jamie Viramontes, who's walking through rows of chili plants on her farm in Deming, New Mexico, about 40 miles west of Hatch.
So when the pickers come through, they're a lot faster than I am at this.
She says those chili pickers have been in short supply for several years. And during the pandemic, the labor shortage that has plagued a lot of industries has only made things worse.
In a good year, we'd see as much as 80 people out here in a day. This season, we were lucky if we could get 30 people out here.
Viramontes says the goal is to pick as many chilies as possible while they're still green. Once they mature and turn red, there's less of a market for them.
We're estimating we lost at least 20 to 30% of our crop due to it turning red because we didn't have enough labor to get into the field in a timely manner.
Over the last 2 years, Viramontes' farm cut chili acreage significantly in favor of less labor-intensive crops, and that hurt.
The hardest part about it is that it is a tradition and it's a heritage.
Fourth-generation Hatch chili grower Victoria Franzoy feels the same way. That's why she's holding strong at the farm her family runs, Chili River, despite another major challenge.
Chili, it just needs a lot of water.
Back when she was learning the ropes, Franzoy says a nearby reservoir took care of that need for farmers.
It was almost overflowing, and that was back in 88, 89. I mean, they were worried about it breaching. We had so much water.
Since then, temperatures in the Southwest have steadily risen. Mountain snowpack levels have declined.
You know, it's just sad. It's sad times that we live in to have this much of a drought.
A 20-year drought that climate scientists say isn't likely to let up. And chilies are also sensitive to other impacts of climate change. Extreme heat, more erratic weather. Franzoy says Chili River Farm is adapting to these many challenges by switching to more efficient irrigation and working with researchers who are trying to breed hardier chili varieties. For her family, she says letting go of chilies just isn't an option.
I don't even want to think about that.
Neither does Melva Aguirre at the Pepper Pot. She says most of her life has revolved around chilies and the people who grow them.
Well, I worry about my people. What are they going to do for a living? You know, these farmers depend on that.
So does her bottom line, and that of just about every business in town. In Hatch, I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Somehow, we're going to make this work.
You gotta believe, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 64 points today at 10%, 35,741. The NASDAQ up 136, 9/10%, 15,226. The S&P 500 increased 21 points, 4/10%, 45.66. Let us talk rain, shall we? It's raining here in Los Angeles today, so of course that's the only thing anybody's talking about. It is, though, a commodity of sorts that's been in short supply in California and other parts west. The so-called bomb cyclone that hit Northern California this weekend delivered a record 5.44 inches from Sunday to Monday in downtown Sacramento. Knocked out Matt Levin's internet, by the way. San Francisco airport saw about 4.0 inches of rain. One geologist, though, told the Sacramento Bee the state's water deficits are just too big, and this is not, quote, a drought buster. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Facebook reported quarterly profits today after the bell. Made a ton of money, that company did. But even forgetting for a minute the flood of stories the past couple of weeks about what Facebook knew about what it's doing to our society and when it knew it, there is a business challenge that company is going to have to deal with, too. You remember those new privacy settings that Apple introduced for the iPhone back in April? The ones that made apps ask whether you want to be tracked across the internet? They're having some big consequences for social media platforms and for the companies that advertise on them, as Marketplace's Matt Levin reports.
The latest Facebook ad from Belgium-based Lindemann's Brewery features, well, beer, a perspiring glass of bright orange red beer surrounded by fresh strawberries. Flying around the glass is what looks like a steampunk beer fairy.
Just a very short gif aimed at stopping you in your tracks, saying, what is that weird fairy character doing?
Danielle Thompson heads U.S. marketing for Lindemann's. She says since the iPhone privacy changes, it costs her twice as much to show that ad to a beer-loving Facebook user. The social media platform has a smaller pool of people it thinks might be interested in strawberry beer, say because they recently visited a brewery website.
And so fewer people means reaching each of those people will cost more money.
That's a budget problem for smaller businesses, the biggest source of Facebook ad revenue. Brian Weezer with the ad buying agency Group M says large companies won't feel the pinch as much, but they should prepare for a future where stalking your customers around the internet isn't so easy.
Marketers have to deal with a world that features more and more privacy. Consumers didn't want to be tracked in ways that were creepy.
Targeted Facebook ads were key for Real Paper, a company that makes environmentally friendly bamboo toilet paper. Marketing VP Jeff Borsick says he's now exploring other media, podcasts, radio, TV, and
influencers and focusing on tastemakers and people that are, you know, for us, passionate about sustainability.
Bamboo toilet paper. Wonder if there are any pandas with big Instagram followings. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Here's an item from the Forum for Sustainable and Responsible Investing. Last year, AUM, that's assets under management, using sustainable investing principles, hit $17.1 trillion. Emily Stewart made note of that in a piece not too long ago in Vox about, broadly speaking, ESG investing, environmental, social, and governance-minded investing, which is, as her piece details, sometimes easier said than done. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So do me a favor, would you, just so everybody knows what we're talking about, give me some real-life examples of ESG investing.
It's things that you see: fossil fuel-free funds, an ETF that says that it's environmentally friendly, or if you care about, let's say, gender equity. There are all sorts of investment products out there to kind of help you supposedly invest in a way that feels ethical and good to you, whether that be private prisons or guns or anything you kind of want to avoid or promote.
That supposedly in your answer there is doing a whole lot of work, because the gist of this piece is all is not as it seems in the ESG investing world.
Right. I think the way I kind of think about it is it feels easier than ever to invest ethically or to be told by marketers that you are. People want to feel like they are doing good with their money. The people who make investment funds have realized that this is what people want. And so they're creating these products that often are not really delivering on what they say. We don't really have a good definition from regulators from what ESG means. And so the BlackRocks and Vanguards or whoever's of the world can slap an ESG label onto an ETF or a mutual fund, charge a little bit more in fees, and it's not necessarily doing anything. They're just kind of shuffling around shares sometimes, or they're investing in fossil fuels maybe when they say that they're not, just less.
Is this something that the average layperson investor can figure out for themselves, or do you have to like know what you're looking for?
You know, it's hard. I think a lot of people go into their 401k, if they even look at what's in their 401k, see ESG and think, oh, this makes sense. Most people have a lot of stuff going on in their lives, and going through what's in their mutual fund and their retirement account is not at the top of the list.
Yes, fair. Totally fair. My hand is raised on that one. You mentioned slapping extra fees on it. There was a Bloomberg piece not too long ago that basically said most of these ESG investments are just glorified and kind of expensive, you know, S&P 500 index funds.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely a lot of it. And one person I talked to for this story is Tariq Fancy, who used to be at BlackRock dealing with their sustainability funds and saying, listen, I've been kind of behind the curtain and see what happens. And basically, it's that we shuffle some shares out of ETF X, we put it into ETF Y, and we call ETF X ESG or environmentally friendly or whatever, but really nothing is actually that different. And obviously, he's just one voice in this, but he's definitely a person who's been talking about this quite a bit lately.
So what's the answer, right? Because not everybody's going to plow through their mutual funds. The profit motive for the people running these funds is very high. Is this one of those where regulators have to come in and say, look, this is ESG and this is not, and now go forth and invest?
Yeah, I think that's an important place to start. Someone like the SEC coming in and saying, hey, here, this actually has a definition, right? If I go to the grocery store and I see something is organic, I assume that means something. And ESG should mean something as well. But I do think more broadly, like, we're not going to save the planet with our 401ks, full stop. And so we also just need broader government regulation on issues like climate.
Are you one of those who goes through your 401k and figures it out?
No, really not. I should. Right. But no,
and
I'm
and
not.
If you and I aren't doing it, then what hope is there, right?
Exactly.
Emily Stewart, she's a senior reporter at Vox, writing most recently on ESG. Emily, thanks a lot. I appreciate your talk.
Thank you.
Live events are coming back, in some places have been back for a while, and that is good news for the musicians and the actors and the artists whose livelihoods were in the balance. It is also good news, though, for all of the other people who are involved with putting on a show, set designers, lighting technicians, even the people writing the signs. And if we had a sign right here, it would say, here's today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Nan Peretti, and I'm a freelance sign writer, graphic designer, and festival worker, and I live right now in Massachusetts, Western Massachusetts. So what I do here is I make signs for people for their birthdays or to ask someone to marry them or to celebrate something all over the country, actually all over the world, in pretty much whatever they like the sign to say. I've been the sign writer for the Jazz Fest in New Orleans and several other festivals around the country for 36 years now. And in 2020, I was in New Orleans. I was down there working on the festival. We knew the pandemic was happening, but we just kept thinking, somehow, we're going to make this work. We had never interrupted Jazz Fest, not even for Hurricane Katrina. And then one day they called and said, we're not going to be able to do Jazz Fest. I was so upset. Then the next devastating part was, uh-oh, this is how I make money. What am I going to do? I figured, I got to figure something out. So I posted on Facebook and said, hey, if anybody would like a sign, I can make one for you. A few people wrote back, and I mean, it was nice. But then there was a woman in New Orleans. She has a company called Flirty Girl. It's a company that does New Orleans-based stuff. They have candles, T-shirts, and she knows marketing. And she said,
on my website. I'm going to take the orders. I'll give you the orders every day. You make the signs, bring them back to me. So we got over 1,000 orders in just a couple weeks. And I was getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, making signs all day, going to bed at midnight. But that was fine. I loved it. And so that's how it really, really took off. Last year in 2020, I made over 5,000 signs. I had no idea in the world this was going to go this direction. I thought it would be a little side business, but it's turned into my main thing I do. And a lot of people have asked me if I want to expand, but I don't want to do that. I love the fact that I'm the one who writes all the signs for all these festivals. And so when you get a sign from me, it links you to the festival. And so I think that's pretty cool. So right now I've copyrighted my fonts so that they're mine and I can keep them in my pocket. And I'll just keep making signs just as long as people want that.
Nan Peretti, making lots and lots of signs in Ashfield, Massachusetts. You can see some of her work and those fonts on our website. And while you're there, let us know how your economy is doing, won't you? You can do it at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, in which the stock market, while not the economy, can certainly see the electric car economy future. Tesla shares hit $1,024 a piece today, in part because Hertz, the just-out-of-bankruptcy rental car company, said this morning it's going to order 100,000 Teslas to restock its fleet. That share value pushed Tesla's market capitalization, which is total shares outstanding times the price, over $1 trillion. That is, in case you were wondering, more than the next 9 car makers in this economy are worth combined. All right, we got to go. I talked too much today, so no moment of economic context. My apologies for that. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.